The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
I had this idea in my head for The Widow. I had the voice, really. I had Jean, the widow, of the title. I had her voice in my head, just not saying much, but it was a germ of an idea. So I wrote 9 chapters and the final chapter, the ending, and then put it away to come back to later, really. Things took off in Sri Lanka and suddenly I didn't have as much spare time. But later on, when I took it out of the drawer, I thought, yeah, maybe this has got legs. I don't know. So I had a go. I joined a writing group in France and they were so encouraging. And I got to 10,000 words and I thought, oh, I'm not sure I've got anything left to say, having only ever written journalistic length pieces. So sort of, you know, between 500 and 2,000 words. So to write 10,000 words was a new experience. And I entered a competition and they said, yeah, you're shortlisted, but you've got to finish the book.
Ed, welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. New York Times bestselling author Fiona Barton spoke to me about why so many famous journalists have turned to crime fiction, the power of the deadline, and her latest hit novel, Local Gone Missing. Fiona's the award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author of novels The Widow, The Child, and The Suspect, all three featuring journalist Kate Waters. Her latest thriller, Local Gone Missing, follows a new protagonist in Detective Elise King and follows the brewing changes of a small seaside town. Kirkus Reviews said of the book, Barton presents such an embarrassment of riches, layers and layers of unlovely revelations about people who seemed perfectly nice. Ed Bookpage wrote, thanks to Barton's airtight plotting and impeccable characterization, a mini break by the sea will never seem relaxing again. In her past life, Fiona was a senior writer at the Daily Mail, a news editor at the Daily Telegraph, and chief reporter at the Mail on Sunday. She has trained and worked with journalists all over the world. In this file, Fiona and I discussed what it was like to be a chief reporter in the UK during the 90s and noughties, why crime reporters don't have time to write fiction, how she made the transition to best-selling novelist, why journalism is so akin to crime fiction, the definition of a duvet writer, how to beat procrastination, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right, we are back on The Writer Files, and I am honored today to be joined by an esteemed guest. I have the New York Times bestselling author, Fiona Barton, is joining us today, and I can't wait to talk to you about all the things. How are you doing today, and what's happening over on the other side of the pond?
Well, it's all gone a bit coronation crazy, as you can imagine. There are paper crowns everywhere you look. Yes, big weekend in the UK, the coronation of King Charles III. I'm having a quieter moment down on the south coast, and I'm editing my next book. I've got my head burrowed into my laptop, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. I can't wait to talk about what you're working on next, and of course, all the things about coronation craze. I want to dig into your kind of superhero origins as a writer, because I understand in a previous life, you were an award-winning reporter and journalist, worked for some marquee titles, and you were the chief reporter at the Mail on Sunday, which is like kind of a bit, you know, it's kind of like a very popular, maybe the most popular UK newspaper, right?
It was certainly up there. Yes, it was a great newspaper to work for in those days. Yeah, I was a chief reporter back in the 90s and noughties, and then became news editor of the Daily Telegraph, and then a writer, feature writer on the Daily Mail before I stepped away from mainstream journalism.
Yeah. So, I mean, I understand that you have gleaned quite a bit, obviously, from that time working as a reporter and kind of use that to fuel your fiction. But yeah, talk a little bit about kind of how you made that career change, like what inspired you to, you know, because I understand you decided that you wanted to do some volunteer work and then you were working with exiled and threatened journalists. But yeah, talk a little bit about that that really interesting transition and then how you came to fiction.
Okay. Yeah, so I'd done about 30 years, 30 plus actually, years as a news reporter. Loved it, absolutely loved it, and news editor. I'd gone onto the desk. But there came a moment, it might have been a moment of madness, but it didn't turn out that way, thank goodness, when I thought I need to do something different. You know, it's I've been doing the same thing for a long time. And my husband and I talked about volunteering overseas when we retired in our 60s. And we just got to talking about why we're waiting. You know, we're in good health. We've got children who are old enough to be getting on with their own lives and parents who don't need us. And so we thought, let's do it now. So both of us gave up our jobs and we went to Sri Lanka. I was training journalists, Tamil journalists mainly, in Sri Lanka, a country where being a reporter is one of the most dangerous career choices you can make. People were being murdered and taken off the streets and disappeared. So I went there. And we went for 2 years and had a really, really life-changing time. And while I was there, I was invited to join a Swedish organization that trains journalists abroad to be one of their trainers. And so I leapt at the opportunity and started working with them, the Folio Media Institute. And we were working with journalists who were exiled or still working in country, but under the wire, as it were. So yes, I worked with journalists from Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe. It was a fantastic, humbling experience.
Interesting. Yeah. And so was it that time then of kind of this big career change for you? And then, of course, you know, kind of that mission statement of helping others, and then it gave you the space and the time to kind of start working on this first best-selling novel, your debut, The Widow.
Yes, absolutely, it was. I mean, I don't know, you know, where you've worked in the media, but a newspaper journalist in those days, it was a full-time job. You know, there wasn't space really for me to do anything else. I had a family, I had two children. So it was only when I stopped being a reporter that I could sort of take a breath really and think about other things. I had ideas in my head, but I'd never had the time really to get them down on the keyboard. So that's when I did it. When I went to Sri Lanka, I had this idea in my head for The Widow. I had the voice really. I had Jean, the widow of the title. I had her voice in my head, just not saying much, but it was a germ of an idea. So I wrote 9 chapters and the final chapter, the ending, and then put it away to come back to later, really. Things took off in Sri Lanka and suddenly I didn't have as much spare time. But later on, when I took it out of the drawer, I thought, yeah, maybe this has got legs. I don't know. So I had a go. I joined a writing group in France and they were so encouraging. And I got to 10,000 words and I thought, oh, I'm not sure I've got anything left to say, having only ever written journalistic length pieces, so sort of, you know, between 500 and 2,000 words. So to write 10,000 words was a new experience. And but I entered a competition and they said, yeah, you're shortlisted, but you've got to finish the book. So I then had to write another 70,000 words. So, but I had a deadline, which is what I'd needed all along, having, you know, worked to deadlines all my working life. So, yeah. I had a deadline and I was working in Myanmar for 6 months with journalists there, helping set up a journalism institute. And that's when I did it. I had those 6 months and I sat and wrote every morning, early and every evening until late and finished it. I'm not sure I would have done had I not had that kind of, you know, perfect storm of a deadline and an environment where, you know, I didn't have to go to the supermarket and, you know, do all the domestic stuff. So that was, I was lucky, very lucky.
Interesting. So it was almost like a far-flung writer's retreat for you.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. That's such a fascinating process. So you had the first 9 chapters and then the last chapter, and then you kind of had done some workshopping, but then the getting shortlisted forced that deadline. And so you'd had this incubation phase. It's almost like, were you plotting it? Do you think you were plotting it in your head then finally sitting down to just, you know, obviously.
I'd had it cooking in my head, if you like, for a couple of years, because I'd started out with an idea that I wanted it all told in first person, direct to the reader. I'd read a couple of really good books that had used that. And I thought, yeah, that's, you know, it's so immediate. I loved it. And then, of course, you start writing it and you think, oh, gosh, this won't work, because you need other points of view. You need the detective who's also investigating. And I had a reporter in that first draft or second draft, in which she was only there really so that the widow had somebody to talk to. And but gradually the reporter's part in the book grew, I think, because I just felt so comfortable in her shoes, having, you know, it was my world. So she grew, she got her own chapters, a typical reporter, foot in the door. And it evolved, and it needed to, you know, it's all very well, you know, this sort of initial idea where you think, yeah, that's going to be great. But when you start writing it, you suddenly find all the pitfalls, all the flaws. And so, yeah, I needed time to think it through.
Interesting. Well, you know, it, kind of as an international traveler, and you've kind of lived like a life of international intrigue a little bit. But then, of course, you know, now you're writing psychological suspense and crime. I thought this article in Crime Reads recently that mentioned it was interesting. It asked the question, you know, why do so many journalists turn to careers in crime fiction? And that list is really a fascinating one, because it is a really great question. They listed Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, Ernest Hemingway, Tom Wolfe, Bram Stoker, which I didn't know, H.G. Wells, Joan Didion, George Orwell, Geraldine Brooks, and so on and so forth. The list goes on and on. But yeah, it's a great question. And of course...
Oh, Kelton, I'm so sorry. Can I just stop you? There's a Spitfire above my shed. Let me just shut the door. Hang on a sec.
Oh, that's okay. There's an airplane.
I'm so sorry. They've chosen this moment to start doing practices for the coronation tomorrow. But it's such a noisy aeroplane.
well, how fitting.
Better if it isn't. Yes, and how fitting. Exactly.
I thought, oh no, they've found your secret hideout.
they're buzzing me. No, yeah. No. So, you're right. There's an awful lot of journalists writing who turn to crime, better than turning to crime, I would say. But but they do, I think it's because we see so many different aspects of human nature in our job, you know, especially if you're a news reporter, general news, where you're doing something different every week, meeting different people from all sorts of walks of life. And particularly, I'm afraid, we see a lot of crime because crime is news. You know, you don't have to, it's politics and crime, isn't it? It's fascinating sitting in a courtroom and listening to the minutiae of the evidence, of the statements, the stuff that, of course, the reader, newspaper or media audience don't get because, you know, you get weeks of it, all the detail, but you're there, the reporter's there listening to it all. And distilling it down into a news story, the most important lines of the day. But you retain so much of it, you know, the way people talk and just, you know, how the person in the dock accused of a terrible crime just looks like the man next door or, you know, the lad that sat next to you on the bus on your way in. It's that kind of insight, I think, which probably I missed when I stopped being a reporter, and I enjoyed exploring as a fiction writer.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, you know, we've kind of come back to a renaissance in true crime, especially I think with the advent of podcasts. But it never really went anywhere, did it? I mean, it was always kind of like, if it bleeds, it leads, right? In the 24-hour news cycle. And then, as you put it, you know, and so what that's done for a lot of us has made us like kind of armchair detectives, but journalists really are detectives in a sense. So it probably wasn't a far stretch for you to then turn the lens and your protagonist now in the latest Local Gone Missing, which is now available in trade paperback. Congratulations on that. Talk a little bit about the kind of the inspiration behind the latest and of course, some great blurbs here, but, maybe the genesis of how you've turned away from, your previous protagonist from the last three.
Well, I poor Kate, after three books, I felt she needed a lie down, to be honest. She'd been under the cosh for far too long. So I started looking, I did work alongside a number of detectives over the years as a reporter. And, I always admired the work that they did, how meticulous it was. When I finished doing The Suspect with Kate, I was thinking about what's it like if you're world is turned upside down by something that you haven't done. So I was looking at writing about a detective, but I didn't want them, you know, the flawed detective. I didn't really want to go down that route, but I wondered what it would be like if your world was turned upside down by ill health, which is, you know, nobody's fault. It's just, it's one of those things. It's an act of God, if you like, but, So I started looking into it and I found these wonderful women detectives who have survived breast cancer. And I talked to them about what it was like, you know, they were senior detectives, what it was like suddenly being felled by this. And then what was it like trying to get back to the person you were before? And I used quite a lot of that to inform Elise King, the detective inspector in Local Gone Missing. We meet her when she thought she had her life completely sorted out. She's in her 40s, mid-40s, and career woman, had decided she didn't want children, had met someone who didn't either, and they had a great life together, and she had everything planned. And she's that sort of woman as well. I mean, she's slightly OCD. You know, she likes an achievable aim. She likes a plan. And then she finds a lump in one of her breasts, and is just everything is sort of pulled out from under her. She has her partner's disappeared, gone off. He's not the person missing. He's just dumped her, unfortunately. She's ill at home and is full of self-doubt. She doesn't think she can be the same detective she once was. Her memory isn't good because of the treatment she's had. Her physical fitness is low, and, you know, she just doesn't feel herself anymore. Luckily, she has a very nosy neighbour, Ronnie, next door, who is a librarian, was a librarian, and is desperate. Is so thrilled that she's got a detective living next door. She's because Elise has moved in, and is desperate to, you know, to hear all about it, about the work and everything. And then a local goes missing, Charlie goes missing, and there's all sorts of other stuff happening in the town. And people think, oh, he's just, you know, he's a bit of a character, drinks a bit, and he's perhaps just, you know, wandered off and he'll be back. But Elise is dragged unwillingly into hunting for him by Ronnie. And then she's off duty, you know, she's on sick leave. But she does get involved, and things take a dark twist, as they always do in these books. It's the story of her investigation with my favourite character, Ronnie, and what she finds out about the town that she's moved into.
It's interesting. And of course, congrats on the reception. Nita Prose, the New York Times bestselling author, had called it a dark and twisty read. And USA Today had mentioned that readers will savor untangling the intricate web Barton weaves. And I thought Bookpage had mentioned that thanks to your airtight plotting and impeccable characterization, a mini break by the sea will never seem relaxing again. I don't really know how to feel about that.
I know, I've ruined it for everybody.
Were you inspired by some of your own experiences in the latest? Obviously, you could have set a novel and, you know, anywhere in the world, but given your world travels and some of your experiences as a journalism and the things that you've seen, was there some seed of inspiration that, you know, kind of maybe brought it a little bit closer to home for you?
I guess so. I mean, the suspect, most of it was set in Bangkok, but my husband and I moved back from France. We were living in France, and we moved back, and we've settled on the south coast of England, sort of between Brighton and Portsmouth. And I'd never lived in a seaside town before, and it was fascinating when we first arrived, because it's all very, you know, sparkly sea and postcards and cafes selling fish and chips and things. But I started looking at the next door forums, sort of WhatsApp groups locally, and people are really angry around here about all sorts of things. And it just got me thinking about it's those little things that can make people seethe quietly until something happens. You know, it comes to the boil somehow. And it'll be over something small. You know, your fence is too high. There's dog mess being left on the street. It's small, small things. And I know from, you know, reading the papers, you know, that people can get absolutely murderous over these things because they build and build. Mm. So I love that. And it was handy sort of living on the spot by the sea. So I could use the scenery, et cetera. And I wanted it to be a small town. So not a village, you know, not cozy crime, but a small town where 10,000 people live And it's small enough that people do know about each other, maybe don't know each other, but know about each other. There's gossip and all of that kind of thing going on without repercussions, really. You may never meet that person you're gossiping about. So, yeah, there were various strands that I thought that could help make this, make the suspense, if you like, the menace.
The menace. Well, talk to us a little bit about your writing process, if you could, before we wrap up here. I know we don't have much time left, but can you just describe kind of like your process? I know you've mentioned that you write in bed, but I wonder if that's still a thing that you do, or are you a morning writer? Are you an evening writer? How do you get kind of into a flow state?
I'm afraid I am still a bed writer, duvet writer. I was in bed writing this morning. It's so easy to sit up in bed, have your first cup of tea in the morning and start writing. And you don't have to have showers and get dressed and go and start up, you know, the heater in the shed and all that kind of thing. You can just get on with it. And it's very comfortable. I can sit with the dog and two cats sitting on the bed with me. It's all very lovely. And it's a habit I got into in Myanmar, really, because I used to wake up very early and there was nowhere else to write, really, in the apartment I was living in. So I stayed in bed. And so I've kind of kept going with that. Hmm. I'm not in bed now. I'm sitting in I'm sitting in my shed, in my garden. So in the afternoon, that's what I do. I have lunch and then I come out to the shed and I'll read what I've been writing. I'll do research if I need to, you know, just kind of tidy things up. But It's the morning when I do my proper writing. That's when I have the most energy, the most energy, really. But I've got fresh thoughts in my head in the morning. You know, other people are much better at night when everything's quiet, but I don't need quiet. You know, years on the road as a reporter, I've written everywhere, you know, in the noisiest places in the world, probably. So I don't mind about noise.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I want to ask you a quick fun one before we wrap up here. Of course, I'll mention your home base. There is FionaBartonAuthor.com, and there are links to social media there as well. The latest, of course, is Local Gone Missing, available in paperback now. And before we just wrap up with your final pearl of wisdom to fellow writers, a quick one. If you could have dinner with any author from any era to your favorite spot in the world, who would you take and where would you take them?
Oh, gosh. We found a fantastic, well, we didn't find it. Stanley Tucci told us about a wonderful restaurant in on the Bay of Naples, the Amalfi Coast, in his series. We did a series about traveling through Italy and eating. So I would probably go there because it was spectacular. It wasn't posh. It wasn't a posh place. It was, it kind of had a pier that went out into the sea. So you were sitting over the sea. Mm. Oh, fabulous. Anyway, that's not what you want to hear about. And I would have their beautiful pasta dish, zucchini pasta. Oh my gosh. I can still taste it. And who would I take? So many. I would love to have had the opportunity to talk to Hilary Mantel, who died far too early. I'm a huge fan of her novels, Wolf Hall, Bring Up the Bodies, and The Mirror and the Light. Extraordinary writer, kind of invented a whole way of telling a story, and I would love to have heard about her and Thomas Cromwell, her love affair with Thomas Cromwell all that time.
Lovely. Well, I know you have to run. Maybe just your final blurb on how to persevere.
Oh, gosh. Everybody will have their own way of doing this. I give myself a good talking to sometimes. But if you want to write something, you've got to do it. No point, you know, doing the housework first, thinking I'll just do the laundry and then I'll sit down. Try and just sit and have a go and don't give up. I know it sounds simplistic, but it's so easy to say, oh, this is rubbish, I'm not going to do it anymore. Keep going. If you believe in it, other people will too.
Don't give up. Perfect way to wrap. Thank you so much, Fiona. We appreciate your time, and hopefully we can wrap again in the future. Best of luck with the latest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.